for the human family we demand it. Just us, truth, freedom, equality's a must. Us, decolonization of the planet. So bust this. People be the power, now we build the justice. Pointing at system divination, how we build the justice. Welcome to Planet to the podcast, build the justice. Build the justice, build the justice, build. Is to add on or do away with it. Justice.
Hello, and welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, otherwise known as CRISJ. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. I am Professor Christina Flores-Victor, and I am here with George Harris, a master's student in the Political Science Department here at Sac State. And today we will be discussing his project, how voter identification laws impact voter suppression. First of all, thank you very much for being here today, George.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. I would like to start off with asking you a few questions about how you came to be here at Sac State. If you could share a little bit about your background and how you came to be in graduate school here at Sacramento State.
So to talk about how I got to Sacramento State, I think there's a few reasons about how I ended up in Sacramento, and there's a couple different ways I could have gotten here. I think no matter what, I knew after undergrad I was going to be in Sacramento. And this was for a couple of reasons. The first one was whether or not I was going to go to school. I was going to graduate school had always been something on my mind, but I never really saw it through too much specifically. Like I always... as I kept going through undergrad, I just wanted to just finish in four and then go start working. But then everything kind of changed with COVID. At that time, I really had to think about myself and think about the change I could make and the impact I can make just with everything going on, how I just felt, I really felt powerless in that moment. And then I really had to look to see the resources I had and the options that I had and abilities I could that I could offer with all of my different resources. And that's kind of what made me to that decision to go back to grad school and get my master's degree. And the second thing about how I could end up in Sacramento was I was a student athlete at UC Santa Barbara as well. I was on the track team where I threw the discus, shot put, and hammer events on that campus. And also because of COVID, I was granted another year of eligibility. And because of this, I wanted to compete in one final year, and I could also get a year of graduate school paid for, which is another way I thought about Sacramento State. I was in contact with the coach almost throughout my whole senior year, and then I obviously had to apply and get accepted to get into the grad program, but it was just another option. And then the last option I had was when I wanted to come to Sacramento, I knew I wanted to work for government. And I wanted to work in either the assembly or the Secretary of State's office specifically. And I was able to get an internship here at the Secretary of State, at the Secretary of State's office, which there was all those different options. And I actually ended up getting a good blend of all of them where I was able to intern and do sports and start the master's program, whereas now I no longer am competing, but I was able to work. I'm still able to work and go to school, which is really fun for me.
Fantastic. Being a student athlete and a graduate student is no joke. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it was a really tough balance, but I mean, I had a really good support system between all of my teachers as well as all of my coaches. So everyone was just trying to see me succeed, which made it the transition and all the difficulties a lot easier.
Excellent. So I am curious about what sparked your interest, you know, around issues of voter turnout, voter engagement, voter suppression. What kind of got you interested in this topic even before you began your thesis project?
Racial disparities have been something that I've always been passionate in, and just seeing The idea, it's really a simple thought. You know, ever since I was a kid, it's like, why can't everyone just get along? You know, it's like, there's something we all thought at some point in time. And it's like, as we grow up, all of the subconscious and like just implicit bias throughout society and stereotypes just force you to think it's okay that certain groups aren't given the same opportunities as others. And I've never really, even though I grew up in those same societies, and I never really understood it. It didn't make much sense to me. And not even just for my minority groups, but also for other minority groups and oppressed peoples as well. But it really hit me during COVID, because that was a really tough time for me. Going back to sports, I was on pace for a really big year in athletics, and having that year taken away from me really made me have to look for it. Had to make me think I may have to stop doing track altogether, and really made me look internally and seeing what I was passionate in. And it was the same time all the protests were going on, and really made me realize what I can do to help people and my communities. And I really got into voting rights as a part of that, because the way I see it is that if we can get more elected officials that look like that actually represent their communities, we could see some type of systemic change. And that's kind of how it led me to voter turnout and election law specifically, and how it harms specific populations and prevents them from getting those elected representatives. So yeah, that's kind of how my whole thought process came to voter identification laws. And I remember my first class with Professor Victor my first semester, it was like we had to come up with a topic on the spot, and like that was the first thing I came up with, was voter election law specifically, and how it harms voters, and just kind of have kept building it from there, and the project we have today.
Sounds like a lifelong interest, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Now, for someone who maybe doesn't have that kind of lifelong interest or commitment to it, and maybe some of our listeners don't know much about or don't know the details of voter suppression efforts or what's going on with voter ID laws, what would you say is the most relevant background that our listeners ought to know before we begin to kind of really discuss your particular project on voter suppression and voter ID laws?
So I think the best way to explain it is, for starters, going over voter suppression, it's most heavily recorded in the South. The Jim Crow era was an era where there was ideologies such as separate but equal, where you had separate rights to different things, but like it could be access to water or bathrooms, where they clearly were not equal under those separate laws and delegations within society. And part of the things that enabled and established that power in Jim Crow was people being restricted to vote. There was laws such as the grandfather clause, where you could only vote if your grandfather had voted. And if your grandfather was a slave in the late 1800s, slaves didn't have the right to vote. So you would never have been granted that right to vote. And it just became a systemic issue. If you couldn't read or write legibly, you couldn't be given the right to vote, even though today all you need to do is just be able to sign your name. So there was a lot of different challenges that existed. But in 1965, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed, which eliminated a lot of these targeted laws that prevented people from voting. And however, recently in 2013, there was a Supreme Court ruling called Shelby County versus Holder. And Shelby County was trying to use some type of restrictive law that was preventing specific populations, specifically Black voters, from voting. And the county at the Superior Court was deemed unconstitutional what they were doing. And the county ended up suing again, and it went to Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court voted in favor of the county, saying that what their law was doing, the state should have jurisdiction over the type of election law they're occurring, which completely overturned the Voting Rights Act, which protected specific populations from a federal perspective. And since that ruling in 2013, a lot of states have much more control over their laws, and have some of these restrictive laws have come back into play. And especially since now, it's been since 2013, we have about 6-7 years of like hard data to look at to see how voter turnout and how populations have been voting since this overturning. And you can see that once again, these same populations have been targeted over time again.
I think that's a great segue to begin talking about your particular project. And you've been working on this mixed methods master's thesis. If you could tell the listeners a bit about your project, and it's specifically on how voter identification laws impact voter suppression in the United States.
So my research, it's a mixed methods, meaning it uses a little bit of quantitative and qualitative analysis for it. Starting with the quantitative piece, I used a study created by the National Conference of State Legislatures, which scaled each of the 50 states' photo ID law on a scale of 1 to 5 in the 2020 presidential election. And I modified it a little bit to make it a little more feasible for a data set with only 50 states. So I condensed it into 3 scales. And those 3 scales were having the least level 1 states, which were the least strict, which do not require photo ID requirements. Then there was the level 2 states that require some variation of photo ID requirements, but voters can vote provisionally without the photo ID. And the provisional ballot just means that the ballot will be counted once the signature or once their registration is verified at a later date. It's not counted immediately. And then a strict state requires photo ID, and even if a voter does vote provisionally, they must return to the elections office within 7 days with ID for that ballot to be counted. And so I compared each of these 50 states' turnout, or each of these states' photo ID law, and compared it to the average turnout for each state. And just off that comparison, I saw that strict states had a 4% lower turnout than non-strict states, which were the level 1 states versus the level 3 states. And then I also used a multivariate regression, which had control variables that were a little more pertinent to my research about voter suppression, which were each state's Black population, the number of polling places where people were allowed to vote per thousand voters. The next variable I used was competitiveness of the election. And this was measured by looking at the vote spread between the top two presidential candidates, which were Biden and Trump in each state. And then I also used the proportional representation of Black elected officials. And this was measured by looking at the proportional representation of Black people in a state, and then comparing that to the number of Black elected officials in the state and federal legislature in that specific state. And when I did that, I found that for strict states, the turnout decreases even further, down to 5%, which looking at some of these strict states, looking at Georgia specifically, that would have represented over 125,000 voters in the 2020 election specifically. So when looking at everything all considered, photo ID law does impact turnout. And when you look at the multivariate regression, which includes Black populations specifically, it decreases turnout even more, which does does ask the question, is photo ID law meant to protect voters, or is it meant to harm specific populations? And I would say it's the second. And in terms of my qualitative piece, it was looking at Georgia specifically as a case study. Looking at election laws that have been passed or rejected over time within the state. And you can see that over time, more election laws have been constantly trying to be passed or have passed that harm voters. The grandfather clause, for example, was a law that existed in Georgia. And then there was laws after the Voting Rights Act had passed that were rejected by the Supreme Court. And again, in after 2013, those same laws that were rejected under the Voting Rights Act were granted during after Shelby versus Holder, which does suggest that, once again, these states have always been trying to hurt these populations.
That's fascinating. I really liked hearing about the additional kind of variables in the study, right? And then when controlling for those, that the impact is actually worse, right, in mm-hmm. states that have these. So why did you decide to do this kind of, I know that a mixed method approach can sometimes be more time consuming, right? To kind of have to do the deep dive into the case study and to also kind of like find all the data and do all that work. Why take a mixed method approach to this particular question? Why was it important to you?
I think it's just partly my personal passion, and I really wanted to showcase the importance and how prevalent and real this issue is. And second, I thought the mixed method would be the most valuable approach because I'm not the first person to say that voter suppression exists in the United States. I don't think I'll be the last, but even if I'm not the first or the last, there's going to be scrutiny saying that it doesn't exist. And if you only use qualitative, which a lot of arguments in modern research that have been created just use qualitative research because they don't have the data to support it, it gets rejected. And if you just have the data without historical analysis and context, then you can't really, then the argument is, oh, this is just a coincidence, or it was only in that specific election. So when you combine the two pieces, you can really create a true, not even create a narrative, you can just tell what's been happening and saying that this is what's happened over time and this is what's happening today, and that, oh, this is not new. This is going to continue to persist unless we try to create some new changes and solutions, because what we've currently been doing has not been working to help voters.
I want to ask you a follow-up on Georgia as your case study. You kind of mentioned a little bit about why selecting Georgia as the case study, but after your selection of Georgia as a case study, did you find that you just still found interesting things you didn't know before, like even uncovered new and interesting tidbits of like voter history and voter suppression history in Georgia?
So I guess there's a couple reasons why I picked Georgia. First, in 2020, it actually, I don't know exactly how long, but it was for the first time in a long time that it had voted Democratic in a presidential election, which was huge to me. And when they showed the voter breakdown of how the state was blue, you'd think that they would vote Democratic every time, because the population in Atlanta that voted Democratic is so much larger than the rest of the state. And it was like, it really made me think, like, this, even though the Voting Rights Act passed almost 60 years ago, like, that there has still been targeted suppression there. And then the second reason why I picked Georgia specifically is my sister, she is a PhD student at Georgia Tech. And we talk all the time. And I remember talking about our voting experiences and how I just had to wait in line for a little bit at my polling place at Santa Barbara. But for her, it was a whole different experience. Just even the process of registering to vote. Like, I ended up registering same day because I registered in San Diego, which is my hometown. But then I had to re-register in Santa Barbara to vote there. But she would have never been able to do that and have her ballot counted, because you have to register days in advance. They don't have same day registration. On top of that, you have to wait in long lines. The absentee ballot, which is a vote by mail ballot in Georgia, you have to request that months in advance of the election. It's much more difficult to vote. And I really just wanted to see why our voting experiences were so different, because it's so easy for me here versus how much difficulty she had to go through there.
It sounds like research runs in your family is what you're telling me too.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
So something you mentioned right here, I think leads into our next question is, you know, we're talking about, you mentioned some of this happens consistently in the South and your case study of Georgia. So, you know, as Californians who do have a lot of these same day registration, vote by mail, you know, why should Californians, or if we're going to be really specific, you know, Sac State students who have a lot of like opportunity to vote on campus and have a lot of maybe things that are not available in Georgia, why should people in California or Sac State students care about this issue of voter suppression or voter ID laws?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to consider is that one of the things that I found in my research is that since 2020, more states have slowly gone down the path of becoming more strict, or even going down to that most strict scale. Two more states specifically have become more strict. So I think that's one thing to consider, is that people are starting to consider photo ID law, no matter where you are in the country. So I think we shouldn't take what we have here for granted, and that we should continue to advocate for our rights, so that way they not only are maintained, but also can be uplifted for other states. We can be a state that works to make other states better. We don't have to just be the model that everyone tries to follow as. We should use our position of power and progressiveness to influence the states around us, rather than just being proud of who we are. That's nice to be like happy to be California. I love to be a Californian, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to make everywhere like California as well. So it's very important to take advantage of every opportunity you have, because not everyone around the country has those same opportunities.
Yeah, and I kind of want to ask you, because I feel like knowing your work, there's a piece of this in here that we haven't talked about yet. You know, people in Georgia, like you mentioned, maybe your sister, are also not happy with the laws, and they're doing things to resist or to counter or to change what's happening in Georgia. So did any of your research in your project, your thesis project, touch on this kind of resistance or this counter movement that's happening even in like a very restrictive place like Georgia?
Yeah. And so, I mean, it is true that there are nonprofit organizations, community-based organizations, and really just community organizers that just work together to increase turnout and try to get people that are being targeted to turn out to vote. As much as that's happening, the problem is that those organizations can only do so much. And when suppressive laws are continuously being passed that target these groups, looking at Georgia again, another law that passed after the 2020 election made it illegal to hand out snacks or water in polling lines or in polling places. So if you're a community organization that gets people to vote and tries to bring them snacks and incentivize them to stay in polling places, which tend to be when there's a larger Black and minority populations have longer lines to vote, when you're waiting for more time to vote and you can't have a snack or have anything while you're waiting for the up over and in some cases upwards of 2 hours, an hour and a half, it makes it even harder for those community organizations to get people to the polls in the first place. So it really is a battle between them. And right now the community organizations are losing a little bit on that end. They're not getting as many people as they could be voting because of the policies that have been enacted. And that's why federal protection was so necessary under the Voting Rights Act. That's why you saw there was such a transformation under that bill that has slowly gone away because it's been overturned. Parts of it have been overturned.
I know that even here in California and at Sac State, when the lines at the polls are really long, they have groups that bring pizza out, right, to encourage students to stay in line, even though right. The polls are closed, you know, hold your place in line. So I can imagine that if the lines are long here for voting on campus, right, in places that have fewer polling places and more difficulty, that the lines are extremely long.
Exactly. Yeah, that is one thing, is that in my research, I did look at the average polling place in each of the three ranks, and it's severely lower in the strict states. It's on average seven less polling places per 1,000 voters in comparison to rank one, which is a very large number.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what the lines must be like, you know, after work when people get in line, or, you know, people try and vote before work. So there's even times in the day probably that it's even worse.
Exactly.
Well, I do want to talk to you a little bit about where you plan to go, you know, from here with your research in the future, or with your career in the future. But before we get to that question, I wanted to congratulate you on your first place for your presentation at the Campus-Wide Student Research and Creative Activity Spring Symposium, and being selected to present your research at the CSU-wide 37th Annual CSU Student Research Competition at the end of April. So congratulations on that. And I heard too that you're a finalist in this year's Sac State Grand Slam, correct?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
Okay. So why is it important, do you think, for you to be disseminating your research, and maybe even not just disseminating your research, but in venues like this where students are presenting research?
I think any place that I can present my research, because I think it's important. And I think that especially when you have research that's student led, you have a lot of young professionals, a lot of different researchers that are going to want to be encouraged to listen to what I have to say. And it's a really good opportunity to present my research and just spread the word and spread awareness, because a lot of these young people, I mean, even at the research symposium on campus, people wanted to talk to me about my research because they were interested in it. And it was just a really good opportunity to just spread awareness of these issues, and that that these issues could still eventually trickle to California, and that nowhere in the country is safe from voter suppression, unfortunately. And that's why we have to stay diligent and be willing to challenge any type of oppression that occurs. And if I can continue to spread that message throughout, now I'll have the opportunity to do that at a statewide conference, which is really awesome to say. And kind of, it's still a little surreal to say out loud now that I think about it, but it's a really good opportunity to present really important research to a lot of different people. So I'm really excited for it.
Well, we're excited for you. If you could kind of maybe talk about one lesson you think you've learned from the research process that maybe you hope to apply to your future career, or even some of your future plans after you graduate with your graduate degree in May.
I think that what I've learned really is that for almost any topic that you are passionate about, you can find a way to turn it into research and find a way to measure it and see how, really just see if whatever your thoughts are true. I mean, I didn't think I was going to ever create a quantitative piece collecting data from all 50 states about photo ID law. I just wanted to see how voter suppression exists today. And I didn't really have a direction from there. The first project I turned in that had this idea listed like 10 different ways voter suppression impacts our society, and which half of them I really didn't know how to measure. I mean, even photo ID law, I knew it existed and I knew it was an issue, but I didn't know that this was something that could actually be measured. But it was through a lot of different research, how I came across the NCSL website, and then just for all the different measures, variables I had, a lot of it was just things I came up with and just spent hours that I don't really want to talk about finding different data points, but some of it was already pre-created. And that is one of the amazing things about social sciences, is that a lot of the data is just out there. It's just our job as scientists and researchers to find the data and use it for new purposes and expand upon what's already been done. And I think these types of skills, I mean, mainly the idea of looking at what's already out there and applying it in new directions, is critical thinking that you can use for any job. I think that part of the data process is important to build a career. The path of research can be directed in any way. And same with critical writing that you'd have to have for a thesis. So I think that while this has been a really great passion project, and hopefully I can expand this research more, I'm excited to have it to get it finished and published in the library and presenting it. But I'm not sure if I want to go down a path of being a researcher. I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought about it and solidified it yet. But whether I go down the path of research or not, these skills that I learned will definitely help me in the future, no matter what.
You have two researchers in the family, right? you can never have too many.
Yeah, that is true.
So what are you hoping to do with your master's degree once you graduate in May?
I don't really have too much of a direct plan. There's a lot of different avenues that I want to go down. I currently work at the California Secretary of State's office, where I work as a policy analyst, looking at all types of different policy that work on promoting accessible election law. This is something I'm really passionate in looking at election law specifically, but I don't necessarily want to limit myself to just working at the Secretary of State. I want to try to see if there's any different avenues possible that can help me promote different laws, not even necessarily election law, but just promoting accessibility and inclusiveness and all different aspects of policy. Or I could just as easily see myself going down the path of a researcher and continuing to find different things within our system that can be researched and looked at and find ways to improve them from a research perspective or from a policy perspective. There's a lot of different directions I can go that way. So,
yeah, definitely. And one last question here. What would you recommend? You had talked a little bit about this in your previous answer, kind of starting to demystify kind of the research project process for our students here. But what would you recommend for future undergrads or graduate students who are just beginning a program who want to pursue research as students here at Sac State?
The main thing I would tell you is that if you're going to pursue the path of research, you shouldn't try to do it just because of the idea of research and how it's the clout associated and prestige associated with having your own research, because it's not fun. Like, it's a lot of hard work. It takes a lot of hours. The amount of days I spent just collecting one portion of one of my variables in the library, I would spend days upon end just looking for the most minute details to finish my data set. You really have to love what you're doing, because you really need the passion, because that's not only going to make you want to keep doing all these extra steps and want to create the best product possible, but it's also going to really make sure that you're hitting all your deadlines, and really you're going to try to create the best possible outcome. I mean, my passion in this topic is what enabled me to create all the different variables I came up with and to even have a mixed method approach. That was one of the suggestions I had, because I wanted to make my research stronger. So I think passion is the most pivotal thing. You have to do something that you love, and that's going to make you not only want to make it the best version possible, but also it's going to help you think of all the different ways that you can make it happen. So that's what I would recommend for sure.
I want to thank George Harris for being taking the time to talk with us today. And George, we kind of want to end with just what you might give to our audience as a call to action, because here at Chris J and at the Building Justice Podcast, part of what we're trying to do here is strengthen ties the community and encourage people to participate and be more involved in civic engagement. So what would you say to the audience, you know, given everything you've learned through your project, through your research, what's one thing perhaps that our audience members could be doing to help with this situation?
Well, I think although my topic is about voter suppression, I think the primary reason why it's so important is because it prevents specific populations from voting. So I think conversely, looking at the other aspect of this, it's how do I get these populations to vote? And even in places that voter suppression does not persist in, you do see these hard to reach populations, these minority populations that still do not vote at the same variances of non-minority groups, even in progressive states like California. So I think we all should try to actively, even if we don't live in a state where voter suppression is occurring, we should still try to promote getting all the people in our communities to vote, people that you know, even in your own families that don't vote, people in your communities that don't vote. You should really try to swing the importance of this and how our values, while you may not vote, they may not vote because your values may not be represented, and they're not being represented because the people that you would be voting for, the people that get voted in, don't care about the values that you care about. You have to make sure that your elected officials actually represent who you are as a person. And that only can happen if people of minority populations vote. Because if minorities never vote, you never get a minority elected official. So it's pivotal no matter where you are to push voting rights and ensure that all populations are participating, because that's the greatest way that we'll see change, whether you're in a progressive state or a suppressive state.
Thank you for ending us with that call to action. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your research and kind of its application for us in California too.
Well, of course, it was great talking with you.
I want to thank everyone for listening, and we hope that our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all. You just listened to the Building Justice podcast. The information contained in this podcast represent the views and opinions of the hosts and guests and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Sacramento State or Chris J.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for Building Justice. Building Justice. Time for